On your behalf, brothers and sisters, I now call upon Brother Kevin Gore to lead us on the subject of Isaiah chapter 20. Thank you.
Thanks, Brother David, and my dear brethren and sisters. Perhaps you may have gathered from David's thoughts and his prayers that Ruth's mum passed away this morning. I find it rather difficult this evening. I hope you'll excuse me. Things may come out at odd angles and we just haven't quite made the grade. But anyway, we'll see how we go. In preparing for tonight, I guess when I looked at Isaiah 20 initially, I thought, goodness me, Pete's got something in for me. I thought, how are we going to make a night out of Isaiah 20? Then he said, well, you can talk about Assyria as well. So that gave us a little more latitude. I guess when we look at Isaiah 20, the thought comes through that in time of perhaps trouble, we may tend to put our trust in a broken reed. And that was really the warning to Israel, wasn't it? You know, we have one in whom we can trust and one who is the rock of our salvation. One in whom there is no shadow of turning, no variableness. And we can be absolutely sure in those things which he has promised to us. As we'll see later on tonight, the prophet Jeremiah was told, wasn't he, to take his sackcloth, to take his girdle to the river Euphrates and there to bury it and to leave it. And then to come back later and to dig that girdle up. And he was told that it was a symbol of the children of Israel. A symbol which was very fitting in so much that as the children of Israel failed to cleave unto Yahweh, so brethren and sisters, to us is that exhortation, that just as that girdle was designed to cleave around the person who wore it, so we should put our trust and our faith and to cling unto our Maker. And obviously we can see here that at this particular time Israel was being warned about relying upon the strength of the Egyptians and the Ethiopians to save them from the Assyrian power from the north. Verse 6 actually shows us that when it says an inhabitant of this isle, you'll see there in your margin it says country, shall say in that day, behold, such is our expectation, whither we flee for help, to be delivered from the king of Assyria, and how shall we escape? In the Amplified Bible it's written a little differently. It says, and the inhabitants of this coastland, the Israelites and their neighbours, will say in that day, see, this is what comes to those in whom we trusted and hoped, to whom we fled for help to deliver us from the king of Assyria. But we, how shall we escape captivity and exile? And of course, brethren and sisters, we very well know the answer to that question, don't we? The beginning of the chapter is very interesting, and in fact I must admit that the more I got into looking at the history of Assyria, I guess the more I was regretting that I didn't start months beforehand. One of the things that really impressed me was the volumes of information that are available about that ancient nation. I guess we tend to bundle up Assyria and Babylon and we put them as two dynasties or two empires, if you like, under the one banner. I can remember as a young person quite some time not really appreciating the difference between those two empires. When we consider that it was somewhere around 605 BC that the Assyrian Empire was finally annihilated after the Battle of Carchemish, and that the origins of that empire, as we'll see in a minute, go right back perhaps somewhere around the year 3000 BC. Though it went through many periods of waxing and waning, nevertheless, it was a very significant empire for many, many years. And one of the outstanding things is that archaeologists have uncovered what's really just an extraordinary amount of evidence, tabloids, prisms, recording details of the empire over many hundreds of years. And we'll talk about some of those things as we go through tonight. In fact, when you come to do your research, you'll find that there's more information available on the Empire of Assyria than what there is perhaps on the Empire of Babylon. Of course, the two, to a degree, were related, and in fact the origins of the Assyrians and the Babylonians were basically the same. Well, our prophecy is that the time slot is fixed for us there, isn't it, in verse 1. In the year that Tartan came unto Ashdod, when Sargon, the king of Assyria, sent him and fought against Ashdod and took it. So we can see then that it's in the period of the reign of Sargon, and it's at the time when Sargon came against Ashdod. Now, by courtesy of Dave here, I think we've got this going. What we'll do initially we can get these jolly things right. Yes, sir. Better? Alright. Now, I've put that up there for a start, just to show us where the ancient kingdom of Assyria was located. We can see here, look carefully, you can see the river Euphrates coming down here. Right, notice how it pinches in there and then moves away and then comes back down here and then eventually meets up and goes into the Persian Gulf. Whereas if we look over here, we see the river Tigris coming down, coming very, very close to the Euphrates, moving away and then coming down into this delta marshland area around the modern city of Basra and then into the Persian Gulf. You can see the area of ancient Babylon down here. You move further up and you'll see the city of Asher, and then further up you see the city of Nineveh. Again, we'll come to those later on. On this map, which David has kindly prepared for us, and there's a little bit more detail on there, so that we'll have to work our way through that now. You see that we've still got that basic area over here to the east, and over here there is Ashdod and Ashkelon, all right, the area of the Philistines. And that is verse 1 is referring to an event when Sargon was actually forced to come against Ashdod. Now, we did some research on this, and you have to excuse these books that we've got lying around here. They're all my props for tonight. But there are one or two references that I would dearly like to be able to get onto, and maybe perhaps research in the public library may reveal them. C.C. Walker makes this comment in relation to verse 1. You see, verse 1 speaks first of all about a Tartan. Who was this Tartan? It's interesting to note that the same expression is used in 2 Kings 18, particularly in verse 17. It speaks of a tartan coming with Sennacherib to Jerusalem. Initially, I suppose up to, I think it was about 1830, there was no actual record of an Assyrian king by the name of Sargon. In fact, the authenticity of it was sort of questioned until a French archaeologist unearthed the ancient palace of Sargon at a place about 14 miles north of Nineveh. And that opened up a whole new world. I read what C.C. Walker says about this particular incident. How Sargon comes to speak for himself in this way. In the record chamber of Assurbanipal at Nineveh, there has been disinterred, among many other records, a broken cylinder of Sargon, which speaks of the very expedition against Ashdod that is in the subject of mention in Isaiah's prophecy. Not only does Sargon's name thus appear, but even his portrait with that of his tartan or commander-in-chief has been discovered on the walls of his palace at Khorsabad. From the cylinder it appears that. Now, there is, one of these books has actually got a picture of this is where we've got to sort through things a little. I don't know whether you can see it here, and it's one of those things I would have liked to have been able to photograph. You're quite welcome to have a look at it afterwards. That's a reproduction of Sargon, and the tendon here, and the tartan here facing him. It says underneath, next to the monarch, the highest place in the Assyrian social organisation was held by a kind of grand vizier, the tartan or commander-in-chief of the royal armies. He is usually shown facing the king in a dignified and respectful attitude. So he was the commander-in-chief of the royal armies. Interesting plate to have a look at afterwards. Now, Brother Walker goes on and says, and basically sums up the reason for this, Azari, king of Ashdod, had conspired with his neighbours to throw off the yoke of Assyria, and Sargon had deposed him and made his brother Hamitai king in his place. But the disaffected princes and peoples of Palestine would not recognise Sargon's vassal king and set Yamani on the throne of Ashdod. In other words, there was a revolt against the one whom Sargon had placed in authority. Judah, Edom and Moab were in treasonable correspondence with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, a prince who could not deliver them, as Sargon himself says in language vividly reminding us in Isaiah chapter 30 verses 5 to 7. Without waiting to muster his entire forces, Sargon at once marched against Ashdod. Apprised of his coming, Yamani fled to the south borders of Egypt and appeared no more. Ashdod, Gath, and Ashdodim were besieged and taken, and Yamani's gods, wife, sons, daughters, treasures, and people became the victor's booty. Sargon repeopled the towns with foreigners from other conquered places and appointed a governor. Afterwards, the king of Ethiopia, overawed by the might of the great king, sent Yamani in chains to Assyria. This cylinder of Sargon is to be seen in the British Museum, and pictures of it are to be found in some of the most recent editions of the Oxford Bible. It is one of the many such things by which the Bible has been confirmed in these last days of a sceptical age. Truly a tremendous witness to the veracity of God's word. The reference, if any of you are interested in following that through, comes from a publication called Light from the East. And if any of you have got a copy of Ellicott's commentary, you also find that he makes reference to that and also gives you the volume and page numbers if you wanted to follow that through. So, truly a remarkable testimony to the first verse of this chapter. It's rather interesting. Something else that I noticed as I was going through my preparations was the way the history of the Assyrians is dated. And it's dated extremely accurately. You know, it says this happened in 616 and this happened in 720 and so on. You think, well, goodness me, how could they be so precise? And not only that, it goes back in not only the first millennia BC, but these dates run back into the second millennia BC and just about to the third. And the Assyrians were obviously very meticulous in keeping records and dating. And in the finds in Sargon's palace, there was a chronology found, which was obviously understood by the ancient Assyrians, and that chronology details the whole history of the empire, going right back to its roots. And the archaeologists have found that the method by which that dating has been done and been recorded is quite accurate. So when it says in such and such a date BC this happened, well, the likelihood is that it wasn't very far away from that sort of time. It's rather interesting. Anyway, back to verse 1 of Isaiah 20. We've got then our time set. About what time was it? Well, we're told that Sargon ruled in Assyria between the years 722 and 705 BC. When you have a look at history, you'll find that there was actually two Sargons. He was Sargon the Second. Sargon the First lived many, many years beforehand. I think I'd mentioned, didn't I, that the Tartan was also with Sennacherib when Sennacherib went up to Jerusalem in 2 Kings 18. You might just note that. It's a title, yes, yeah. It's not, the Tartan's not actually the name of a person as such. It's not a proper name, it's more a title, the commander-in-chief, as we indicated. The quote from Ellicott might be worth just having a look at. Ellicott's comment in relation to this, it's similar to what C.C. Walker actually says, but I'll read it out. In relation to Sargon, in fact, I'll go just a little bit before. He succeeded Shalmaneser the Sixth, the conqueror of Israel. Incidentally, it's while Shalmaneser may have came against Israel, it would appear that Sargon actually, as it were, finished the job off, but that's another story. In BC 721, at first as guardian, co-regent of his son Samdan-Malek, and afterwards in his own name. Sargon, his reign lasted till BC 704, when he was succeeded by Sennacherib. Long inscriptions giving the annals of his reign were found by M. Botta at Khorsabad and have been interpreted by M. Offert. The occasion of the campaign at Ashdod is related by Sargon in the annals just mentioned as happening in his 11th year. Azuri, the king of Ashdod, refused to pay tribute and revolted. Sargon deposed him and placed his brother Akhizamit on the throne. The people in their turn rose against Akhizamit and chose Yaman as their king. Sargon then marched against the city, took it and carried off its gods and its treasures as booty. These events naturally excited the minds of Hezekiah and his counsellors and led them to look to an alliance with Egypt as their best protection. Well, faced with the imminence of Syrian conquest, the prophet Isaiah now is commanded by Yahweh to give a sign to his people. At the same time spoke Yahweh by Isaiah the son of Amos, saying, "Go and loose the sackcloth from off thy loins, and put off thy shoe from thy foot." And he did so, walking naked and barefoot. And so once again, God requires a prophet to do something extraordinary in order to teach a lesson to his people. We might reflect upon perhaps the yokes that were worn by Jeremiah, the time when Ezekiel was commanded to lie on one side and then on another, or perhaps the horns of Zedekiah. And so we see how that Isaiah was commanded to really present himself as a captive, as a prisoner. And for 3 years he was required to wear no sackcloth and to go barefoot. Take the sackcloth from off thy loins and put off thy shoe from thy foot. The sackcloth was actually a rough garment that was worn by the prophets. In fact, we can just have a look at a couple of references supporting that. First of all, in 2 Kings 8, and I'll just quickly look at these, just note them. Second Kings chapter 1 verse 8. So it's speaking about the garment that was worn by Elijah, and of course we can relate that also to John the Baptist. And they answered him, "He was an hairy man and girt with a girdle of leather about his loins." And he said, "It is Elijah the Tishbite." So you see how he had this girdle of leather about his loins. Of course, we can relate to that, can't we? Peter's expression to gird up the loins of the mind. Zechariah 13:4 is another quote then that we can relate to that, because in Zechariah, the reference actually is to the prophet, and it's used in the context of discerning between faithful and false prophets. In Zechariah 13 verse 4 it says, "And it shall come to pass in that day that the prophets shall be ashamed, every one his vision, when he hath prophesied, neither shall they wear a rough garment to deceive. And so again, that rough garment or garment of hair, as the margin indicates there, was the sign of a prophet. Verse 5, but he shall say, I am no prophet, I am a husbandman. He was a deceiver. In 1 Samuel 19, verse 24. First Samuel 19 verse 24, and he stripped off his clothes also and prophesied before Samuel in like manner and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Wherefore they say Saul also among the prophets. What I was particularly looking for was a reference to the short tunic that was worn near the body. But if we take up, let's have a quick look at 2 Samuel 6, 14 to 20. Got a reference again. It says, and David danced before Yahweh with all his might, and David was girded with the linen ephod. All right, so again, you've got this idea of a girdle about him. But Jeremiah 13, verses 1 to 11, is one I particularly want you to have a look at. I think there's a very powerful lesson in this. Again, the prophecy which Jeremiah was instructed to carry out as a sign to Israel. We'll work through the verses. Thus saith Yahweh unto me, go and get thee a linen girdle, and put it upon thy loins, and put it not in water. So I got a girdle according to the word of Yahweh, and put it on my loins. And the word of Yahweh came unto me the second time, saying, take the girdle that thou hast got, which is upon thy loins, and arise, go to the Euphrates, and hide it there in a hole of the rock. Significant, of course, that Jeremiah is instructed to go to the Euphrates, the area of the seat of power of the nation which was eventually going to come and take the nation of Israel into captivity. So I went and hid it by Euphrates as Yahweh commanded me. And it came to pass after many days that Yahweh said unto me, arise, go to Euphrates, and take the girdle from thence which I commanded thee to hide there. Then I went to the Euphrates and digged and took the girdle from the place where I had hid it, and behold, the girdle was marred, it was profitable for nothing. And then the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, thus saith Yahweh, after this manner will I mar the pride of Judah and the great pride of Jerusalem. This evil people which refuse to hear my words, which walk in the imagination of their heart, and walk after other gods to serve them and to worship them, shall even be as this girdle, which is good for nothing. For as the girdle cleaveth to the loins of a man, so have I caused to cleave unto me the whole house of Israel and the whole house of Judah, saith Yahweh, that they might be unto me for a people, for a name, and for a praise, and for a glory. But they would not hear. And there was the calling of Yahweh's people, brethren and sisters. likewise ourselves, are called to bear the name of our Maker, are called to reflect praise and glory which alone is due unto him, called to cleave unto him as the whole house of Israel and Judah was. And yet people of Israel failed to do that. And our second verse gives us a picture of one taken into captivity, the hairy garment removed, the linen girdle revealed to show shame and contempt, brought about by the fact that the wearer had been faithless in his or her responsibility. And so Micah mourns this situation in Micah chapter 1 verses 8 and 9, where he says, I will go stripped and naked. So that it underlines the fact that it was an act of shame.
Yes.
Yeah. And that what we've got then is as these captives depicted in all their shame and humility. Alright, well, back to verse 3 of Isaiah 20. And Yahweh said, like as my servant Isaiah hath walked naked and barefoot 3 years for a sign and a wonder upon Egypt and upon Ethiopia, so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians prisoners and the Ethiopians captives, young and old, naked and barefoot, even with their buttocks uncovered, to the shame of Egypt. Of course, while the prophecy is initially talking about the Egyptian and the Ethiopian, verse 6 brings the prophecy right home to roost, doesn't it? When it says the inhabitant of this country will go down that same road. The fulfillment of this particular part of the prophecy is interesting in my reading, because when you're sort of preparing these things, you read this and you read that, and sometimes I'm not the sort of person that always marks some of the more important things. You think, yeah, I'll go back and I'll get that in a minute, and then you can't find it. There was one extract where I found where actually Sargon, after taking Ashdod, he then went down into Egypt and conducted a campaign down there. But it would seem that the downfall of Egypt didn't happen until a little bit later. It was actually the prophecy in its fulfillment was carried out by Esarhaddon, who was actually the king after Sennacherib. In Unger's Bible Dictionary, and there are other records of this, but I've got Unger's here, I'll just read this. This is in relation to Esarhaddon. So you've got Sargon, and then you've got Sennacherib, and then Esarhaddon. Esarhaddon was a notable king, very very much so. In fact, one of the main things that Esarhaddon did was to rebuild Babylon. It's interesting, of course, as you get this toing and froing between Assyria and Babylon. There were several periods in Assyria's history where there were installed in Babylon Assyrians who were actually controlling the city and so on, and then they were overthrown. But at this particular time, Esarhaddon had control over Babylon, so he was an Assyrian in Babylon. And one of the principal things he did was to actually rebuild that city, and he's quite famous for that. I'll just read what it says here. Esarhaddon continues his description of the rebuilding of Babylon. And this again is found on one of these clay tablets. I summoned all my artisans and the people of Babylon in their totality. Babylon I built anew, I enlarged, I raised aloft, I made magnificent. You know, they weren't backward in coming forward, some of these fellows. Esarhaddon also defeated Taharqa, the pharaoh of Egypt. The triumph over Taharqa was commemorated by the victory stele set up by Sejil in North Syria, recovered in 1888 by the Germans. In actual fact, we've got a reproduction of that, and again, you might like to have a look at this this later on, this victory stele, and it's a relief showing Esarhaddon's conquest of Egypt in 671 BC. Read what it says. The king is depicted with a mace in his left hand, and in his right he pours out a libation to the gods, symbolised at the top of the stele. Ropes extending to the lips of two figures at his feet are shown in his left hand. Taharqa is evidently one of the figures. The other seems to be Belu of Tyre. Esarhaddon thus boasts of himself. I am powerful. I am all-powerful. I am a hero. I am gigantic. I am colossal. That's the translation. And for the first time, an Assyrian monarch assumed the new title, King of the Kings of Egypt, boasting concerning Taharqa, King of Egypt and Ethiopia, daily without cessation I slew multitudes of his men, and him I smote five times with the point of my javelin, with wounds from which there was no recovery. Memphis, his royal city, in half a day, with mines, tunnels, assaults, I besieged, I captured, I destroyed, I defeated, I burned with fire. So it's interesting, isn't it? You get those comments, the coming out of the past, out of the annals of history, and verifying these prophecies. Now, obviously, there are other prophecies which speak about the overthrow of Egypt, and even though Esarhaddon speaks in words like this, we also read, don't we, in Jeremiah 46:26 and again Ezekiel 30, about the scattering of Babylon, the scattering of Egypt, the punishments which would have come upon that nation, and that they were to be carried out by the power of Babylon. Okay, I thought that was quite interesting to have a look at that. And so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians prisoners and the Ethiopians captives, young and old, naked and barefoot, even with their buttocks uncovered, to the shame of Egypt. And they shall be afraid and ashamed of Ethiopia, their expectation, and of Egypt, their glory. The Jews, seeing this, seeing their source of support and strength, the nation in whom they put their trust and confidence, now being taken into captivity, one would have truly expected them to look inwardly and to look to their Maker. And the inhabitants of this isle, or this country, shall say at that time, behold, such is our expectation. Whither we flee for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria? And how shall we escape? And the inevitability of conquest is staring them there in the face of verse 6. Tonight we're looking at both the prophecy and the nation of Assyria. I'll just go back a little bit. We'll put that one up again and we'll try and give you a little bit of an idea of the ancient history of that area. I'll use this map. This one's not quite as much detail on it as David's, but the ancient area of Babylon down here, the Sumerian area, you can see where it's actually got Sumer in here, Elam over on this side, and then moving upwards, you'll see you've got the city of Asher. Then you've got the river Zab. You might notice the river Zab, and that's the one there, the river Zab. And then you've got, of course, the Tigris coming up here, and you've got the city of Nineveh. Now, in ancient times, Nineveh was not actually the capital of Assyria. The capital was Asher. But obviously any country has got to have a focus, it's got to have a point for producing its produce, and the fertile area of Assyria was actually located here between the river Zab and the Tigris, and working back here towards the mountains here, back towards the highlands. Down here in the area of Babylon, and remember what's his name in Iraq? Yeah, what's that fellow's name? Yeah, Iraq. Come on. Hussein, yeah. He was the modern day, wasn't he, Nebuchadnezzar. Well, the present city of Baghdad, of course, is located not that far away from the ancient city of Babylon. It's down here in these lower regions. And these lower regions, apparently fairly flat, you're only looking at a height, say, of about a few hundred feet above sea level. It's much hotter down here, the type of agriculture is different. The date farms are down there, and that sort of environment. But when you move back up into here, apparently it is much cooler. You're looking at a height above sea level, getting back up into this area of 1,500 feet, which of course we can relate, I guess, to the Adelaide Hills in a way. In fact, the rain that they receive in that area, while it's not really abundant, nevertheless, it's enough to enable agriculture to take place generally without irrigation. And the cooler climate, fruit and vegetation and so on, is found up in that fertile area. So it was an ideal place for the nation of Assyria to be based. The actual origin of the nation, we just have a look at that. We come back to Genesis 10, verse 22. Come back to the history of the nations. So we're talking about a nation of antiquity. Right, in Genesis 10, verses 10 to 12. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. Out of that land went forth Asher and builded Nineveh and the city Rehoboth and Calah. And Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, the same is a great city. So Genesis 10 is telling us that the ancients of Assyria came out of Babylon, out of the area here of Babel, and moved north. in Genesis 10 verse 22, we read how that these people were of Semitic origin. Verse 22, the children of Shem, Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, and Ladanaram. So Asher is of Shem. Some of the ancient tablets which have been found, and this is really quite truly amazing, some of the information that's come to light, is what is known as the Cappadocian tablets. Now, while I haven't actually been able to find a lot of written about what actually was on those, I would have liked to have been able to give you some examples word for word. But nevertheless, these Cappadocian tablets are very illuminating as far as the ancient history of Assyria is concerned. Because at this time, and we're talking about a period somewhere around about 2,500 to 3,000 years BC, which is an awful long while ago, isn't it? To find clay tablets, records, which are aside from what we've got in our scriptures, speaking about Assyria trading across here towards Phoenicia and across to the western areas. In fact, in those early days, it appears that Assyria was quite a significant trading area. One of the earlier records of the beginnings of the Assyrian nation says that there were 17 kings who lived in tents. They were in effect a nomad sheikhs, I suppose. But it speaks of the origins this way. It also says that Asher, however, also seems to have been a northern outpost of Sumerian civilization. And so we've got the ties that exist with Sumeria, right, the area of Babylon, and here. And that is very evident when you have a look at the lower levels of the excavations here in Assyria. There is very much an akinness with the ancient pottery and the artefacts of the Sumerian area. The country of the nation as such, like I guess many nations over long periods of time, waxed and waned. Just a few points, and they've been accurately apparently documented that in the year 18, or really from the years 1800 through to 1380, would appear that the Assyrian Empire lost quite a lot of its ancient glory, and for some hundreds of years the Assyrians were tributary vassals to the kings of Hurrian, Mitanni and Haugalblat, who were located here in these areas of northern Mesopotamia. It wasn't really until Shalmaneser the first came on the scene from 1280 to 1260 that again he moved and he conquered, and also he built. And amongst the cities which he built was Kala, which is about 40 miles south of Nineveh. You can see Nineveh there on our overhead, and you can see Kala here. Then again there was a period of decline, because while after he had been reigning, Babylon here also strengthened its position. There was insurrection for a while. He actually had his son reigning here in Babylon, so Assyria had control over Babylon, and then there was insurrection within the household and his son was killed. The Babylonians strengthened their position, and it resulted in a weakening of the Assyrian position. However, by about 1100 BC, there was a great revival under Tiglath-Pileser, and Asher again became the capital, and the trade routes to the West Asia were secured, and there were many national improvements. So Asher again becomes the capital, here we are, and there are secured now trade routes back here towards the west. What is interesting then, that there is another decline that takes place between the years BC 1100 to 900. Assyria suffered at the hand of Aramean nomads. In other words, the people who lived in these highlands in this area up here moved against Assyria and weakened the nation. What is interesting about that, that's of course the period of time which would coincide with the reign of David and Solomon. And Yahweh, working in his wisdom, had weakened those powers here to the north, which of course then allowed the kingdoms of David and Solomon, which were of course a type of the kingdom to come, to be established. While the northern power there was temporarily weakened, of course we look for the day when the northern power shall be utterly consumed and the kingdom allowed to grow and to fill the whole of the world. But it's interesting the way in which God works to allow those things to take place. There were then a series of kings who came upon the scene. There was Tukulti in 890 to 885, who instigated a revival with some brilliant military campaigns. Ashurnazarpal, who was his son, who's recorded as being a ruthless warrior and cruel. He successfully campaigned in the northeast and the northwest and reached the Mediterranean, and it's recorded that he made the Phoenicians to pay tribute to him. That was 885 to 860. And then from 860 to 825 was Shalmaneser III. What's particularly outstanding about this leader was the fact that he, for 26 years, led every campaign that he was personally involved in. And it would appear that he was the first of the Assyrian kings to actually come in conflict with Israel. In 1857, he captured Carchemish. You can see Carchemish, you've probably heard of that town before, you can see it up here. And again secured and the Mediterranean trade route, which of course was utmost importance to them. It's not only interesting to note, incidentally, that trade was in agricultural products. These Cappadocian tablets that I was talking about, which were found, had their origins several thousand years BC, also record metals such as gold and silver being traded in the, along the ancient caravan routes. Of course, we can cast our minds back too, can't we, to the time of Abraham and to the time of Joseph, for example, when those caravan route trades were obviously established, and they were lifelines for the nations of the day. In 722 to 705 is the particular period when Sargon comes to the throne. We'll jump a little. There were several other kings before him. There was a period of decay from between 782 to 746, but Sargon was instrumental in pulling the nation together again and establishing it as a very formidable power. In fact, of all the kings, probably the most is found in relation to Sargon. Now, as far as Sargon is concerned, we've got, of course, Nineveh here, but above is a place called Khoshabad. And it was at Khorsabad that the gold mine, if you like, of findings was made in relation to the history of the nation. What had happened was that Sargon had decided to build a new city, a city for himself, and it was wasn't initially named as I was trying to think what the initial name was. It wasn't Khorsabad. There was another name for it. Let's see if I can find the book that it was in. Well, we're looking at that.
The name basically is
that's right.
Sargonburg
or something like that. Yeah, it was. No, that's there was another name for it as well. But anyway, when they discovered this, actually, it was discovered by accident. There was this French archaeologist in about 1830 was looking for ancient Nineveh, and he was a little out. He was about 14 miles to the north. He found this mound of dirt, and away he went. And what he actually uncovered was, we'll call it Sargonburg. And you can see here a reconstruction of the city. And it was truly a glorious place, and not only from that point of view, its architecture and the immense amount of engraving that was found there in the way of ancient carvings, there were also these prisms and tabloids which were found there, which have been subsequently found to be of tremendous historical importance. It was amazing, though, just in that period of time, what he did with it. Beg your pardon? I don't know where that was, actually.
Which is
called Sargonburg. Yeah. That's all right. Yeah, well, we haven't got an overhead of that one. You may be able to see it there, but there's the facade of the inner temple of Nabu at Khorsabad. Give you some idea of the grandeur of that place. So he was not only a conqueror, but he was very much a builder and an architect. I might just read a little bit about the findings. It says that the excavations at Khorsabad, a chap by the name of Botta and his assistants continued to work at Khorsabad for about a year and a half. In that time, they worked out the general plan of Sargon's palace. They also recovered, either physically or by drawing and detailed descriptions, a fantastic treasure of artefacts. At the conclusion of his campaign, he was able to ship a large number of antiquities to France, including specimens of the huge relief statues of winged human head bulls of stone, which guarded the gates of Der Sharakin, there we are, and the king's throne room. In 1851, the French government assigned Victor Place to reopen Khorsabad excavations, and he worked there from there until 1855. Place succeeded in completing the excavation of the palace and in gaining a fair idea of the plan of the town, which we've got an indication up there. By the time Placer concluded his operation, scholars were already hard at work translating the inscriptions which Botta had copied and published. Excavations at Khorsabad were again reopened in 1928 by the Oriental Institute of the University of Chicago. This group is credited with having rescued some of the best preserved reliefs taken from Sargon's palace up to that time. These excavations were continued until 1936. As a result, some corrections in the details of the palace and town plans were made, together with the recovery of a great number of interesting artefacts. Chief among these, and of great historical importance, was a copy of the official list of Assyrian kings from high antiquity down to the 7th century BC, the famous Khorsabad king list. For many of the latter kings, including Sargon, the years of reign were given in such a way as to make positive dating possible, which could be checked and chronologically confirmed, and along with information in the scriptures. Dur Sarikin was the last of Sargon's capital cities built to his personal specifications. Previously, however, he had used Asher, Kala and Nineveh as his capitals in that order, and his memorials have been found in each of them, but more lavishly at Dur Sharakim than elsewhere. Bas reliefs on city walls and inner palaces walls depict with graphic realism various aspects of Assyrian life. Scenes celebrating events in the conquests of the king were numerous. It has been estimated that if the sculptured bas-reliefs found at Dur Sharakim were put end to end, they would make a continuous panel a mile long. Inscriptions appeared everywhere, commemorating the royal exploits in conquest and battle, together with foundation and dedicatory inscriptions related to buildings. Numerous inscribed clay tablets dealing with the different affairs of Assyrian common life in the times of Sargon were found here and at other sites. It's really tremendous, isn't it? When, you know, a minefield of that ancient information is found, and it dovetails then in with the scriptures and verifies the things which we have our soul and soul confidence in. We've got a few slides there that we might just throw up, Dave, very quickly. Andrew, perhaps can you just put those in for me, please?
I'll just pull these out quite quickly so see some of the, at least most of us have seen some of these reliefs when we've been thumbing through our historical books, and of course I just can't tell you what all of them are, but what is significant about this one, just hold it there, Andrew.
The Assyrians, of course, were known as a ruthless people. They were fearless in conquest. They were ruthless in their tactics. And I don't know whether you can make it out here, but there they all are, the heads of their captives being piled on. You see that? So you've got a bas relief there of soldiers piling the heads of their victims, one on top of the other. Pretty gruesome stuff. With this particular one, what is interesting here, of course, when they came against Lachish, when they were moving in to take a city, and see the ancient old machines that were used here. We've got the soldiers with their bows and arrows, and then moving behind these devices, they could move in close to the city walls and yet have protection. They were quite cunning. While the instruments of war that they had might seem very archaic as far as we're concerned, nevertheless they developed quite sophisticated techniques, including tunnelling, for example, to take cities, as well as using various machines in warfare.
See the prisoners that fought in Wales.
Where are they? Up the top here?
No, they were dying.
Whereabouts?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there we are.
They did that to demoralise the people in the cities.
So they basically hung these prisoners there.
And to demoralise the people.
Yeah. I can't tell you just which one it was. So keep going. Right, there's the head of the man, the winged bull. Now, alright, you see that there is his face there. Recreation. There are pomp and circumstance in the palace of an Assyrian king. Again, the head of the man, the winged bull there, which is some part of the religion. Just trying to see what I can read it. Can you focus that up a bit, Andrew? I'll just read down.
Beautiful.
Oh, yeah, beautiful reconstruction. Can't say that. It's also very significant root instruction too. Like, I can't tell you what that one is.
This is quite a piece.
Right. You see here captives, and I think they're actually slaves carrying, you see wolf here, for example, and other items. Doesn't really show out of that clearance. Do you reckon that's the one, though? It looks like it, doesn't it? With the conquest of Egypt.
Yeah. Or unless it's one of the kings, see, it's pretty cold there. You might have gone on the line.
Yeah, I'm not sure on that. Actually, I think I've got those in a book here, which you can find instructions to afterwards. You just flick through those books. Here's some looking cats. Priest and Syrian priest, that was. Brothers and sisters, I thank you for your patience tonight, and hope that's been of some interest. I certainly found it interesting and somewhat bewildering as I tried to pull those facts together. I guess just one thing I'd like to say is in relation to Mum's passing, I'd like just to thank everybody who gave expressions of well-being during that time, and thought perhaps in thinking about tonight, one thing that just really struck me through the experience we've had over the last several weeks, and I thought I would leave it, particularly for young people's sake, and it's very much more for my own sake, and no doubt others older amongst us would appreciate this, but you know, Ruth's mum was very close to us all, and has been over the years a tremendous example in the truth to us as a family. Those who know the personal circumstances that she's endured over many years would appreciate that. But what really struck me in our experience was her tremendous faith. But in those last weeks and days when what was before her was plainly obvious, as she was the one that had to walk down the valley of the shadow of death. And I think perhaps, you know, we sort of We know that's the case, don't we? We can only, as individuals, when that time comes, walk down that valley. And the tremendous faith and conviction that she displayed was an outstanding example to us. But the other thing that really struck me was this, that if ever you find yourself in a position where the bedside of a loved one who's going through that experience, you can be there and can be there to help them through that time, then in a very real way you're comforting them and helping them in those last days, in that dreadful walk, as it were, down the valley of the shadow of death. You can be there to read the word, to comfort them, to hold their hand, to encourage them. Young people, when you go to visit somebody who's sick, take your courage in your hand. What they are concerned with are the things of the kingdom. Open your Bible up. Read passages of scripture which are going to encourage. Encourage them. It will be to your eternal benefit and to theirs. And I think that that was something that I personally really learnt out of the last several weeks. And if I can just leave that perhaps as the end of tonight, as we've looked at the fortunes of the children of Israel and what came upon that nation because of their faithlessness, perhaps in their own lives and in the real issues of life, that we can show mercy and compassion and understanding, and above all, let's base all our actions and our thoughts upon the principles of the Word of God, and look steadfastly for that day when the latter-day Assyrians shall be destroyed and when Yahweh shall establish his kingdom in the midst of the earth. Thanks, Dave. Well, just one other thing. Mum's funeral will be at the Enfield Cemetery at 1:30 tomorrow.